So I'll just say something about myself, for those of you who don't know me. My name is Bishop Apani. I'm a member of the Trimatna Buddhist Order. Been a member of the Order for 25 years. Celebrated a reunion, an anniversary. So that's been a very important part of my life for many years. And Trimatna has always had a social dimension, an idea of changing society, changing the world that we live in, so that the Dharma isn't just for me. In fact, that whole idea that it could just be for me doesn't really make sense. So if I am interested in changing myself, I'm also interested, another dimension of that is changing the world around me. How do we do that? One model is that we create our own Buddhist world, a new society which can potentially replace the old society. And that's a project that many of us have been involved in. But the old society is still there, and our new society is rather small. So there are other approaches to changing society. There's the activist approach, and that's very important. When there are things that need changing, and there are many things that need changing, an activist approach is, generally speaking, an oppositional one. Protesting, you know, trying to induce change in that way. And that's important, but it does, again, set us on the edge of society. There's the change that we may try to instill through our work, perhaps as social workers or teachers or, you know, that sort of thing. That's very important. But often when we're in that work, we feel we're doing our bit, often in spite of the system and in spite of the world around us. So of course there are no solutions, but there is no single approach. But I want to talk about the other thing that I'm involved in, as well as Trimatna, which is the mindfulness movement and its potential to address some of the major issues that I think face our world, face our culture. And again, I don't want to be simplistic or naive about how this thing that I'm involved in can change everything and all our problems will disappear. Of course they won't. But I think it's very interesting as development. It's a very different development, say, from the new society approach. It's not about creating our own world, it's about getting out into society as a whole, but with something that we have, you know, the people who, my kind of background, have distinctively to offer, which is our experience of meditation and practicing mindfulness. So, I said that we're talking about the big picture, and so the title, Can We Create a Mindful Society? And please don't just shout out no in response to that. The title comes from, or is connected with, a project that I was involved in. I suppose I should say a little bit about my own background before. So I'm a mindfulness teacher. I've taught many, many courses for the general public, mostly in Cardiff, where I live. I also, these days, find myself doing lots and lots of work in the criminal justice system, working with men who've just come out of prison, going into prisons, working with prison staff, with prisoners. And that's very interesting work, it's very powerful work, and I'm not going to talk about it. I've talked about that Buddha Film Festival, I'm not going to talk about it again. But it has given me a sort of a way into a certain area of society I've never had any contact with had I not been found myself doing that. So I may be touching on that sort of thing as we go along. Another area of this mindfulness work is engaging with Parliament and with policymakers. So Can We Create a Mindful Society? That alludes to a report that I helped edit and produce that was the work that was in the name of the Mindfulness All-Party Parliamentary Group. That's great, isn't it? There is such a thing. So, over the last few years, there have been mindfulness classes in Parliament for MPs and members of the House of Lords, and 150 parliamentarians have taken a mindfulness course there. So that's interesting in itself. They being politicians, very quickly got interested. I wasn't doing that teaching. I've met the groups, but I haven't done that teaching. They got interested in how can this mindfulness stuff, which is great, they liked it, influence policy areas. So that was what we worked on with the Mindful Nation report, taking four policy areas. These were health, education, criminal justice, and the workplace. And in each case, we surveyed the research, we looked at the field, what was happening, we looked at the possibilities for further development, and what government might do as part of that. So that was all very interesting, and I was just in Parliament about 10 days ago when there was a two-year review. Where have we got to, 2 years on from the Mindful Nation report? And, you know, all of these fields are developing, particularly mindfulness in schools, developing very, very quickly. Mindfulness in mental health mindfulness-based cognitive therapy has been recognised by the National Institute of Clinical Health Excellence, NICE, since 2003. And so that's a project to develop that, but it's spreading in other ways. So that's all very interesting. But there is something a bit limited once you start to talk about policy areas and implementation and blah, 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 blah. So I'd just like to expand. That what I want to do in this talk is to expand the scope of what this signifies, because it is quite remarkable that there's something which is based in spiritual traditions, or at least deriving from them, which is having that kind of contemporary relevance. So why? What? And how? How does this interface with the biggest challenges that our society is facing, the biggest ones, not just how can this help make a few people feel a bit better? So, before going any further, I want to acknowledge the criticisms which have been made of mindfulness as a sort of societal force. There are many criticisms, and there's actually quite a lot of validity in a lot of the criticisms that are made. So people see mindfulness growing up in a Buddhist context where it's embedded in a whole view of life and a web of ethics and values, often connected with community, with a holistic vision of what it is to be a human being in our breadth and also in our spiritual depths. So that's how I've learned mindfulness, and that's what I value about it. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have HR professionals delivering mindfulness interventions to reduce workplace stress and so on. And the concern is that, even that might be okay, the concern is that when they do that, they're pursuing a corporate agenda, which is to reduce absenteeism or to enhance resilience, which sounds good until you realise that what it means is enabling the employers to put more burden on the poor workers so that they can keep going for longer before they fall over. So if that's what mindfulness is about, then it's not a very inspiring prospect. And no doubt it is used in that way. There is as a world of mindful colouring books. And I always wonder with them, I can sound a little bit cynical now, but what would the difference be if you took the word mindful out and you just had colouring books? So there's the way things get commercialised. And there's also something I was hearing about recently, which is mindful sniper training. Apparently, mindfulness is one of the key elements of training snipers these days. So, this isn't very ethical, is it? And I'm not advocating that. But I would just make the point that if you no longer consider mindfulness meditation to be your own, you put it out into society as a kind of a gift, it will be appropriated. It will be used in all of these ways. One just has to accept that. Either you choose not to put it out, and in a way that isn't really a choice because it's happening anyway, or you try to guide it and influence it, which is my approach. But yes, I suppose it also makes the point that there's nothing intrinsically ethical or value-laden about the fact that people practice meditation. One hopes that will have a beneficial effect. But there's no guarantee of that. So, I said what and why. So what? I'm saying this because, you know, as you can tell, I come from a world of being very involved in all of these developments and so on and so forth, but I don't want to assume that you know what I'm talking about. Meditation is one thing. Mindfulness is something slightly different. Meditation, I would say, is what you do for a period of time when you're really concentrated and focused, probably got your eyes closed. Mindfulness is a faculty that we can apply in any aspect of our life. So when I talk about mindfulness, the mindfulness movement, mindfulness-based interventions, generally speaking, what that means is particular ways in which these practices, both meditation and mindfulness, have been shaped, formed, turned into particular protocols. The best known one is mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was developed by someone called Jon Kabat-Zinn. Often in the UK, what we teach is a variant of that called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which has had a lot of been informed by clinical psychology. So it also means the kind of meditation that's taught in a decontextualized way. For example, through apps. There's an app you've probably heard of called Headspace, which millions and millions of people use. I mean, it was recently valued at $200 million, which is a lot of money. So a lot of people are using Headspace. And that's influencing society in its own way. And I also came across a figure that in 2009, according to the Pew Institute for Research, 15% of Americans had a meditation practice. That's a lot of people. It's about 40 million people. So mindfulness is going into society in all these ways. Meditation is going into society in all these ways. But it speaks to something. It speaks to a need. So people, yes, some people have always meditated. But why is mindfulness being taken up in schools? Mindfulness in education is becoming a very substantial movement. I heard in Parliament that 80,000 school children have learned meditation in schools, and that's growing very rapidly. Why is this happening? I think the answer is that it speaks to a wider concern with the mind and with mental states, which for a variety of reasons, which I'm going to be touching on, have become very important in our society. We need to think about our minds. We need ways to look after our minds, to how our minds are. So mostly what we're dealing with with mindfulness is using these kind of practices in a way that help people psychologically. They don't have to be limited to something that's really just meditation and a few things around meditation. In some of the teaching that I do in prisons, actually, I follow something that's developed by an American Buddhist teacher, while he was a prisoner for many years, we use ethics. We talk about being radical responsibility. We say you're responsible for everything in your life. I'm starting to talk about karma and the six realms. You know, you create this world of threat around you. You know, it's not reality that you need to be on guard all the time. You know, we need to step out of that. So we also look at identity. You know, how do I create my identity? What is my core identity? And by the way, I'm going to be doing a workshop on this tomorrow, if you're interested in getting a taste of the kind of work that we do in prisons. So really going very deep into who am I? How did I get myself into this place? How does my life shaped itself? Trying to name the core kind of existential questions that face you if you're, for example, serving a long prison sentence. So it's not just psychology, it's not just meditation. Potentially what we're dealing with is finding ways to use the wisdom, for someone like me it's going to be the wisdom of Buddhism, in non-Buddhist environments in a way that speak to people's minds because they have a need for something that will help them with their minds and with their experience. So, I want to talk about this in relation to a number of, you know, the sort of macro trends in society. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the mental health crisis. Then I want to talk about the well-being agenda. Thirdly, I'm going to talk about the attention economy. And fourthly, I'm going to talk about the fourth industrial revolution. So I told you you need your heads on and get out of the Buddha field fuzziness, because there's going to be some ideas here. So the mental health crisis. I've already alluded to that. Why do people come on the courses I teach? Because they're stressed. Because they have long-term problems with anxiety, stress, and depression. This is an increasingly pervasive element of our society. 16% of people report some kind of low or medium level or severe mental health problem over the last 12 months. World Health Organization says that depression will be the main health problem by 2030. It's going to overtake cancer and heart disease. So adolescent mental health problems. I just listened to this, something about this on the radio the other day. They're tracking generations. And 10 years ago, 9% of 14-year-old girls reported that they had symptoms or experiences which you could call depressive. Now it's 24%. 10 years later, it's 24% of teenage girls report depressive-like symptoms. They say we're not diagnosing people, but it's feelings of unhappiness, anxiety, to such an extent that it's pervasive. So something is happening in our society, and schools know about it. The mental health services know about it. There's a mental health crisis, and politicians know about it as well. There's a mental health crisis that's growing worse and worse year by year. Why that's happening is another question. I'm not really going to address that directly. Mindfulness isn't about, or any intervention, isn't about completely changing society so that people don't get these problems anymore. It's about dealing with what's there in front of you. But there's a very strong driver towards things that will help, things that will help you manage stress, help you manage your mind. And that's what's driving schools, that's what's driving criminal justice system, workplaces. You know, even if that's for selfish reasons in workplaces, you know, they've got to run themselves, haven't they? So that's the first way in which mindfulness is coming in. The latest research says that, and I heard this in Parliament the other day, so it must be true from an academic, actually, when it comes to avoiding depression relapse, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a standard intervention, is now shown to be more helpful, more effective than antidepressants. So that might sound rather marginal, but actually the implication of that is huge. What that means is it's more cost-effective, people feel better about themselves, and they have better outcomes if they take up mindfulness-based cognitive therapy than if they take antidepressants. Of course, it's not either or. Some things would be better for some people than other people. But if you consider the billions of pounds that are spent by the NHS on antidepressants, that becomes a very significant policy shift there, potentially anyway. So all of that is developing, mindfulness as part of mental health, and the fact that we have a mental health crisis. But of course, the significance of that mental health crisis lies upstream. What's causing it? So I'll talk a little bit about the well-being agenda. So I heard someone called Richard Layard talk about this. Now, he was the head of the London School of Economics. He's now a Lord, and he was one of the people who brought mindfulness into Parliament. He devoted his life as a sociologist and an economist to looking at how the welfare state could function better. And the welfare state goes back to Nye Bevan, to the Attlee government, and to the what Bevan called the five giants, and I actually can't remember what they all are, but they're also want, hunger, ignorance, and a couple of others. You know, in other words, the agenda that lay behind education, behind social work, behind housing, you know, knocking down the slums and building more slums. So that agenda, which goes back to the 1940s and 1950s, so someone like my father devoted his life really to that agenda. But Layard paused at some point because he was very struck and troubled by the statistics that showed, although people's physical well-being was improving, their levels of mental well-being had stalled. They haven't really changed since the 1950s. People are still as happy or unhappy now as they ever were. There seems to be a glass ceiling. Up to a certain point, you know, if you, like some of the guys I'm dealing with coming out of prison, they're homeless, they go to food banks. Now, actually, they need practical help. But there seems to be a ceiling where you get your basic needs met, and getting more stuff doesn't actually make you happier. So what are we doing? Not only that, we've got what I was talking about earlier, this rising tide of mental ill health. Even though we're much, much more affluent as a society. Now, that wealth isn't distributed equally, and the inequality is one of the drivers of dissatisfaction. But what Richard Layard has developed, along with others, is what he calls the well-being movement. And it's identifying the fact that there's a kind of sense of well-being that has to come from within. So the elements of well-being that he identifies are meaningful work, being physically active and healthy. Now, he's not saying that you have to have this, and therefore if you don't, you can't be happy, because obviously a lot of people don't have physical health. Nonetheless, if you're healthy, that's going to be a support to your well-being. Contributing, the capacity, the experience of contributing to society and to other people, family, and mindfulness. So mindfulness being a sort of X factor, something that people can take in and develop. you know, develop something inside. Because the others are external. You may or may not have health. You may or may not have a family that that gives you emotional support. You may or may not have meaningful work. You can always find ways to contribute, probably. But you can always cultivate mindfulness and cultivate a sense of inner awareness and satisfaction. Okay, so the attention economy. That's the third thing I want to talk about. So why is it that we have this sense of, well, this growing mental health economy, this growing mental health crisis, and why is it growing so quickly among particular groups such as young people and adolescents? And I'm not going to try and answer that question in a round. You know, that's the stuff of whole fields of research. But one area I do want to talk about is the attention economy, and you may or may not know what I mean by that. It's something that's used in the fields of marketing and advertising, and it identifies the fact that attention is a commodity. Marketers and advertisers want our attention. They track, when you're watching, you're trying to develop TV advertising, you track people's eyeballs. Where are they looking? Or if it's on a social media screen, where are people's eyes going? How's their attention drawn? Where do they click? So, attention, our capacity to pay attention, or where we place our attention, is a commodity. It's a huge part of the modern economy. And it goes along with advertising and with consumerism. All of these forces are encouraging us to compare how I am now with an ideal state or an idealized state. I am someone without a holiday in Greece. But look, I could be someone with a holiday in Greece. I don't have a big car, but hey, what if I had a big car? But I don't have a big car. I'm dissatisfied. I need a big car. Etc. That's how marketing works, advertising works. It feeds our dissatisfaction. In other words, our attention is constantly being drawn to things that will make us dissatisfied. That's the role of marketing and advertising. Therefore, the capacity to pay attention and direct attention in a helpful way is an essential aspect of being a modern citizen. So, therefore, if we want to support well-being, we need to enable people to become mindful citizens. The mindful citizen who's equipped to manage these forces. So, next, the next area of society I want to talk about is what you could call the non-utilitarian state, or sometimes called the relational state. And this is a set of thoughts that was developed in the Labour Party and by social thinkers connected with the Labour Party over a 10-year period, and really after Tony Blair and before Jeremy Corbyn. And the person who's particularly championed this is John Crotus, who is one of the people who's learned mindfulness and then has made a connection between this view of the state and mindfulness practice. So let me explain. I don't know how many of you work in public services. Many of my friends do, and I've been, in a way, doing that through my work in criminal justice and working with other people. And over the last, whatever it is, 20 or 30 years, the nature of public services has changed. How we envisage schools and hospitals, teaching, healthcare, and even criminal justice, actually, has changed on the basis of neoliberal economics. It's not just that things are being privatised. It's also that certain ideas about efficiency and targets have really colonised those professions. My teacher friends tell me about the effect that has on them. So Crudas and his friends have been thinking about this and connecting it with one of the key ideas of mindfulness. So with mindfulness and with the psychology that's associated with it, we're learning more, we're getting a clearer sense about what induces personal stress. And it's what I was talking about a moment ago, with that sense of a discrepancy between an ideal state, how I ought to be, the person, the body I ought to have, the lifestyle I ought to have, and my actual state. And by comparing, if I constantly compare myself now with how things should be, I'm going to make myself unhappy. So that, put very simply, is a sort of cognitive psychological account of how stress arises. And mindfulness, you know, you focus on the present moment. You notice when you're drawn to this ideal state, and you just realise that's an idea. You come back to what's here and now and what's alive in your life at the moment. So it's that discrepancy. And really, that's that psychology you can map onto the target-driven public service. There's an ideal that's set up. You, individual teacher in class X, need to achieve these literacy and numeracy results. You need to have this percentage of A-level passes at grades A to C, or you're in trouble. And we're going to inspect you and make sure that that doesn't happen. So there is a role for targets in our life, in our personal life. There's a case for goals, for getting out of bed in the morning and wanting to achieve things. There's a case for being clear about what it is that we're trying to achieve. But if we're constantly comparing what is with the ideal, then we're going to feel unhappy. Hence, stressed out teachers, stressed out nurses. And there are some things that you can't capture in a target like that. So the big agenda, one of the big agendas in the NHS is compassion. We need to roll out compassion through the system. We need a 25% increase in compassion to be phased in by 2025. I'm only slightly caricaturing the way I sometimes hear people talking. So if you stand back from that, you know, we do need a more compassionate health service. So how do we make that happen? If you're sitting in Whitehall and you hear these scandals about care homes or nurses who don't seem to care, then how do you change that? And the simple answer is you set a target and you enforce it. But clearly it doesn't work. It's counterproductive. And the explanation for why it doesn't work is somewhere in that psychology of stress that I was talking about. Because it induces a sense of comparing how I am with where I should be, rather than being present. So a relational state is one that values connection. The state itself has a role in facilitating human connections between teachers and students, nurses and patients, and so on. So we see this, I know this is rather abstract, we see this in relatively small scales in the mindful classroom, that a teacher can control themselves. And, you know, particularly in primary education, teachers can shape the atmosphere in their classes, and many people I know are doing that. In some cases, there's at least an aspiration to create a mindful school. And that's a school which has a pervasive atmosphere, also a pervasive ethos, and an idea about what it's trying to achieve, which is really about fostering mindful students. Students who find well-being from within and not simply through their performance against exams and other similar criteria. So The idea of the non-utilitarian state or the relational state is magnifying that that process, which is already underway. And we don't really see mindful hospitals yet, but it's only a matter of time. There's one mindful university somewhere in Australia. I mean, whether it's actually a mindful university.